a big welcome, of course, to Amy Walter. And we cooked up a winter storm just for you because
yes,
it's classic. You know, it's New Hampshire. It's the primary. So here's what we're going
to
do for the next hour or so. Amy will give a presentation for about 15, 20 minutes. Amy, you can sit or we can give you a roving mic if you want to do sort of, you know, Oprah style. And then we're going to I will ask a couple questions that I have prepared for Amy, and but I don't want to take all the time. Then I'll open it up to you. So Amy will talk for about 15, 20 minutes, and then I'll do about 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll leave the rest for you. Michael Brindley will handle the mic. So there's Michael at the back. Just think Michael, Mike. He'll come and bring it around for you. So just kind of raise your hand. That's fine. We'll wrap it up around 7:30 or a little after. We know some of you have slippery commutes home. And again, we really appreciate you coming out. And I can't wait to hear what Amy has to say. So Amy, please go ahead. And when you're done, we'll continue with our program.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And thank you for having me, New Hampshire. Actually, I just want to interview all of you as voters, real New Hampshire voters. We've had this challenge in Iowa, and it happened again today, trying to meet voters, especially when you're going to campaign events, right? We have the microphone. Let's interview real people as they're struggling with their choices for candidates. And in Iowa, there is a flourishing, and I think New Hampshire too, a flourishing political tourism business that people are coming from all over the country to be able to see candidates. I mean, because you get an opportunity in a space like this to sit next to somebody and ask them a question who could be the next president of the United States. So I think we got people when we were in Iowa from Detroit, New Mexico. It's not just obviously a lot of Kansans, but it's not just next door. People are literally flying. We met a woman today in line at the Pete Buttigieg event from Baltimore. So you all, even in the depths of winter, you can bring tourists up to New Hampshire. Good job. And you got rid of all, now it's mostly the automatic toll booths. So as someone who, I went to college in Maine, so I know of the weather. I'm quite not fond of it, but I remember it. But also the toll booths are what really reminds me of having to get through that before you made it to Maine. So things have changed a great deal, but bringing folks up year round, your primary does that. Look, let's just sort of start with where we are at this moment, which is somewhat a state of confusion, right? Iowa is supposed to give us some clarity. We've been desperate, I think. As political reporters, we've been desperate. I think voters have been desperate for the very first voters, Democratic voters, to help sort of cull the field and make sense of what was an unwieldy process and give us an answer. Who's the best candidate to take on Donald Trump? That's what we heard from Democrats in Iowa. We hear it here. We hear it across the country. The candidate we want is a candidate who's best suited to beat Donald Trump. Yes, there are candidates yes, there are voters who are concerned about certain issues and like certain candidates. But for many, they were not willing to absolutely fall in love with a candidate. It was a little bit like dating around, right? They were dating. And this sounds a little bit harsh, and I don't want you to think that this is my marriage. But sometimes you don't necessarily marry the person who makes your heart beat really fast. You marry the practical person, right? Like, this person is really fun and exciting, but maybe not the right person to settle down with. And that's what it seemed like voters were doing. But we come now, what are we now, 3.5 days from the caucuses without an actual official winner. But it's pretty clear what happened. And you guys probably have a good idea of what happened, too, that Bernie Sanders, the unsurprising winner of at least we think the total votes cast, may also win the most delegates. But Pete Buttigieg becoming somewhat of the surprising candidate in either first or second place, a place that had been occupied by Joe Biden, by Elizabeth Warren. And in a sense, then, Iowa helped to at least for a moment, make clear who is who's occupying basically the two lanes in this primary. The one that I have called since the beginning of this process, the revolutionary lane. These are the candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. You can put Andrew Yang in this category, too. Their goal is not so much just beating Donald Trump, which, of course, they talk about they want to do, and they see themselves as best positioned, best able to do that. But what they really argue is that the bigger problem in the country is not just the president. It's the structural, it's just the everything in the country is suspect. The economic system, the political system, the justice system in the country, all of them have been undermined. For Elizabeth Warren, she argues it's money that's the corrupting influence. Bernie Sanders argues it's both money, but also the sort of the political process that has gotten us to this place. So they're asking, demanding, focusing on big structural change, not just beating Donald Trump. And then there's the other lane that I called the restoration lane, the lane that says basically, let's kind of just go back to the way the things were before Donald Trump. Like, maybe we could pretend that never happened. It was just like all of a dream, and we'll wake up in 2020, and that didn't happen. And we're going to go along with our lives kind of the same way we'd done before. Sure, we need to make some changes, but voters are exhausted by the last 3 years. They do not want to go through another big upheaval with another president. And Joe Biden had been the leader in that lane, and it looked like no one could surpass him. And at the national level, that's still true. But in Iowa, it was Pete Buttigieg who was able to occupy that, because what he combined was a practicality that Biden had been pushing with an inspirational message, right? I'm not just the practical middle-of-the-road guy, but I'm also a generational shift, right? Think of all of the candidates, Pete Buttigieg would say, who've gone on to win the Democratic nomination. They were candidates who turned the page from one generation to the next, right? Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, John F. Kennedy, those were the folks that won. When we stay with sort of the older status quo, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, look where we end up, even Al Gore, why not turn the page? And that message resonated much more so than the just traditional practical message that Biden and Amy Klobuchar were also pushing. When we were in Iowa, I mean, I was really struck by how much Biden leaned into just a pure electability message. It really was, you guys, you don't need to love me, but you need to know I'm the strongest candidate, so just go out and vote for me. And we were at an event a couple weeks before the caucuses where one of the folks he brought along with him, a big Iowa name, she's the former first lady in Iowa, Kristi Vilsack, got up to the stage after he left. And, you know, the job of that person is to get the crowd all riled up and to get them to sign these pledge cards, right, that say, I'm definitely going to vote for Joe Biden in the caucuses. And her pitch, and I'm not kidding, the pitch was this: I need you all to be practical Iowans that I know you are. Now, politics is a lot of things, but passion usually gets people to the polls, right? What gets someone to a caucus? You got to sit there all, like, out, in this case, probably felt like all night, but usually at least a couple hours of your night you have to dedicate to doing this. So it's usually you want to be really bought in, passionate about your candidate. Practicality doesn't get people out the door. But because, as I talked about earlier, this real deep concern among voters that Trump is needs to be defeated, and they need to Democrats need to find the perfect candidate or the right candidate or the best candidate to do that, Biden thought that that was going to be his lane, and he spent all of his time focusing simply on that. That just wasn't enough. So the question that we're left with, as and you all are left with here, it seems to be, is this what the final two will look like as we move into the next phase of the campaign? is this going to be a Bernie Sanders in the more progressive lane, as I said, the sort of revolutionary lane, and Pete Buttigieg as the standard bearer in the moderate and restorative lane? I think Buttigieg is going to get a lot of competition. I don't think Joe Biden is certainly not just going to roll over and let him have it. Elizabeth Warren is also competing with a lot of his voters, as well as trying to get some of those Bernie Sanders voters. And Amy Klobuchar also wants to be seen in that. So we have a debate tomorrow night where we can see just how it keeps buzzing. But where, you know, we'll see how significantly he gets challenged from those candidates in that lane. Finally, just a look at where we are outside of the Democratic primary and where the president sits right now at this moment in time. As we know, we just had a vote in the Senate. The president was acquitted, as was not a surprise for everybody. But he sits now, at least in the most recent polling that we've seen, at either the highest approval rating he's been at of his presidency or at the highest end of his approval rating range in a variety of polls, ABC, Washington Post, Gallup, Quinnipiac. And, you know, you would think the president getting impeached normally doesn't improve his standing, especially when 45% to 50% of Americans believe he should be impeached and removed. Bill Clinton, we remember, was incredibly, at least for his job approval ratings, popular. His approval ratings never dipped below 60% during his impeachment hearings. But that was at a time when less than a third of Americans thought he deserved to be impeached. Now you have almost or half of Americans believing the president should be impeached, and yet his approval rating somewhere around 43% to 49%, which just goes to the biggest point of all, which is that this country is as divided. If you thought it could be more divided, or couldn't be more divided than it was in 2016, it actually can be. Or maybe the better way to say it is the divide has now become deeper, wider, and more cemented. And we go into a 2020 with a president who is unlikely to hit a popularity that any traditional president would hit with economic optimism where it is right now. This disconnect between the president's job approval rating and his job approval rating on the economy is unlike we've ever seen before. We have close to, even in the, let's see, when was this? I think this was like a couple weeks ago. The Fox News poll had Trump's job approval rating on the economy close to 60%, but his overall approval rating was about 44%. So he's getting credit for the economy, but not getting credit for how he's behaving as president, which has been a longstanding issue. And it really is the fundamental question then going forward. The president does not seem throughout his entire presidency to be interested in growing his base, in bringing more people into the tent. His message is basically, this is our tent. You either like it or you don't. You want in? Great. If you don't, get out. And you're not on my team anymore. And the choice for the people in the tent, you got to stick in the tent and vote with me. And he's counting on the fact that, and this is especially true when we look at the Electoral College math, there are more people in the tent, especially in some of these swing states, that have yet to even vote. Maybe they didn't vote in 2018, they didn't vote in 2016. They'll come out and support me. Then there are, that's the bigger benefit to him than trying to win over skeptical or ambivalent voters. And it worked in 2016. The question, of course, is that enough in 2020? So that was a lot, but is that a good place to at least start?
That's great, or you okay. can keep going.
No, I mean, we can do it all quick. There's two.
Wow, there's okay. so much. Amy, right. thank you so much. Yeah. And again, I will take just about 15, 20 minutes, and then I know you have a lot of questions, okay. too, and I can't wait to hear what you have to say. So since you ended with impeachment, let's start there.
Okay.
How do you think, Amy, this whole impeachment process, and it has been long,
yes,
has affected, in general, the nomination process, you know, New Hampshire, Iowa, Nevada, everywhere else, and specifically here in New Hampshire?
It's a really good question. I think part of the reason why the president's approval ratings are at a high point for him is that it has energized Republicans and coalesced Republicans in a way that it hasn't with Democrats. And I think part of that is, you know, it's some of it's human nature. When you see someone that you like being attacked, your instinct is you got to circle the tent, right? Circle around the person who is under siege. And for the other side, it's dispiriting to see, okay, gosh, for all these months, Democrats and a lot of folks in the liberal wing of the media have been telling us that it's just a matter of time before the president gets impeached. We have the Russia stuff and the Mueller report and all of my, you know, message boards and my social media is telling me it's just a matter of time. They've got him now. No. And then out comes the story about Ukraine. Now this looks bad. This is bad. He can't get out of this. There's a whistleblower. There's the transcript where he says, do me a favor. There are witnesses. We've got him now. Oh, no, not got him. So that is somewhat dispiriting. And so what we saw when we were in Iowa was really voters, and this is before the vote, Democrats were like, we know what's going to happen. He's going to get acquitted. Republicans, there aren't 20 Republicans in there who are going to convict this guy. So we got to keep our focus where it matters, picking the candidate who can beat him in November. That's the thing that's going to happen. He's not leaving any sooner than that. And what we also have seen in these polls, and this is the thing that I look at when I look at job approval rating, isn't just do you approve or disapprove, it's how strongly you feel about that. And since the beginning of his presidency, there's been this really wide gap between people who say they strongly approve. So basically, that's your core base. That's the nothing, literally nothing he can do will dissuade me from loving him. And then there's the strongly disapprove, which is, I hate you with the fury of 1,000 burning suns, okay? Now, that group, normally, okay, traditional politicians, presidents, that's usually 1-to-1. As many people really love you as really hate you. With this president, it's been really tilted toward the really dislike much more than the really like. So his base is strong, and you see them. He's going to be here on Monday, and you'll see the folks lining up in the MAGA hats. They are an important constituency for him. But as I said, they make up anywhere from like 25-29% of all voters, whereas the people who strongly disapprove are somewhere between 40-50%. But in these last few weeks, you've seen, at least in a couple of the polls that I've been looking at, and that intensity gap in the Wall Street Journal poll, the ABC poll, has narrowed. So again, I think it's that Democrats realizing this is never gonna work, and somewhat dispirited Republicans like, we knew this was a hoax all along, we're gonna be behind our guy. Do I think it lasts? No. How long has anything lasted in this last 3 years? Anything that we thought was a game changer, dominate the news cycle. A news cycle now is 15 minutes. It's that. Maybe 2 minutes. We're already moving on to something else. So I don't think this is going to be a driving issue in the 2020 campaign. Now, look, if stuff does come out, right, Bolton's book or someone comes out of the woodwork with a I have it all on tape kind of situation, sure. And Congress is going to keep beating this. Lindsey Graham and Republicans in the Senate are going to try to get Hunter Biden up in front of their committees. The Democrats in the House are going to try to get John Bolton or anybody involved on that side. So it's going to continue. But I think voters have pretty much made up their mind about this, and they know what the end game is.
Given the fact that you said, Amy, that this whole thing has energized Republicans and sort of made their coalition and their coalescing even stronger, is it a mistake for the Democratic Party, writ large, I'm talking Congress and others, not just running for president, is it a mistake for them to continue this narrative? You know, if you're a Democratic presidential candidate, do you kind of want to say, look, just let it go so I can talk about health care?
I mean, you know, notice that the Democratic candidates don't talk about it. They really do not make it a focus of their campaign in the way that congressional Democrats have. And, yeah, I think this is the challenge when you're the out party. Is that when you don't have a nominee yet, your party then is whoever's in Congress, especially if you control Congress. So it is the quote-unquote Democrats. The nominee is basically Congress right now. When the nominee gets chosen, that candidate gets to drive the train. But yes, if I were the Democratic nominee, I would want to say, okay, look, we did it. He needs to be held accountable. I agree with what you did. Great. Done. Now let's talk about, to your point, now let's talk about health care. Now let's talk about what the president did on X, Y, and Z and get back on the offense.
What's your view, Amy, as an outsider of New Hampshire's position in the presidential nominating process?
Yes. I've been told it's been going on 100 years. Everyone likes to boast about that. And look, political reporters, we love this stuff. It's fun to come back every 4 years, right? You have sort of fond memories of voters and places, and you get familiar with it. But, you know, Iowa did you no favors. And to be fair, I've been skeptical that Iowa could keep their caucuses for years. I mean, in 2012, I remember this so well. It was 1:30 in the morning. Waiting for, it was then the Republicans, where Rick Santorum was, or no, at first it was Mitt Romney who was up by like 8 votes and declared him the winner, only to find out later that there were ballots that I think they had been transcribed incorrectly. So they did a whole deep dive and audit, and Rick Santorum ends up being declared the winner 3 weeks later. Didn't help him very much. In 2016, a lot of controversy, and Hillary Clinton won narrowly. And it's true. I walked out every 4 years saying, this, I cannot believe that this still exists in the 21st century. It's arcane. It's opaque. It is crazy. People are in a room like this with sheets of paper, sometimes they're written on the back of a pizza box, and that's, you're choosing the leader of the free world potentially like this? That's crazy. It makes no sense. And, you know, Iowa, you know, oh, this isn't, we're not choosing anyone. It's a process. Isn't this quaint? And isn't this like so Americana, right? Your neighbors and you're all together, you know, flexing your political muscles, whatever. It's ridiculous. You kind of equate it also. So every 4 years I say that, and every 4 years it reappears. And it's a little bit, there are a couple things going on. The first is what seems now to be the biggest deal in the world, 4 years from now we'll have kind of forgotten it. It's sort of like having kids where after the first one, you do wonder, like, there's no way. How did human beings ever reproduce? Like, we're never, ever having any more children. This is ridiculous. No one told me it was this hard. It's horrible. And then suddenly that fades a little bit. Like, was it really that bad? I mean, she was a good baby, right? I mean, it wasn't bad. And then next thing you know, there's number two, right? But if you really think about it, you're like, that's insane, right? We can't do that again. And that's kind of what the caucuses are, and New Hampshire. And so that happens. And then the fight every year, folks aren't willing to have that within the party to sort of have that fight. But I think the bigger challenge is, especially as the Democratic Party becomes a party that is identified with voters of color, with younger voters, going to Iowa and New Hampshire, which do not fulfill that diversity, becomes harder and harder to justify. But it really has to come ultimately from the very top. So whoever the Democratic nominee is would have to say, that's it, we're scrapping it. Now, that's hard to do if, say, for example, you're the candidate that won Iowa. Now you want to get rid of it? Oh, so because it was unrepresented. So you, should you not be the, right? So it's a very, is a very difficult process. Now, what New Hampshire has going for it is it's a real primary. People understand how that works. It's not this crazy system. But once again, you go to the, shouldn't we maybe start somewhere a little more diverse or maybe just warmer? I mean, Arizona is lovely this time of year, and I would not mind spending some time there. You guys are great, but I don't know. Phoenix, it's probably 64 right now.
Well, the Boston Globe recently weighed in, and I know you know this, Amy, saying we're not demographically diverse enough, economically diverse enough, we're older, and so forth. It sounds like you agree with the arguments, but it just on the ground, practically, it's going to be really difficult. Hard to make that change.
That's right. It's difficult to do. But look, things happen. I mean, we saw major changes to the Democratic nominating process from 2016 to 2020, driven in large part by the Sanders supporters, who did create a system in Iowa that is even more complicated,
yeah.
Right? Now, they didn't make the app. They didn't tell the Democratic Party, why don't you use this app and not really test it thoroughly before the entire world is watching this process. That is not their fault at all. But the creation of these three different tranches of data was part of the reform piece to make it look more transparent. But it was also pretty clear, as we saw today with Sanders declaring victory, what the rules were driven in part by what is the strength of Bernie Sanders, which is an ability to really generate enthusiasm among voters. But in a system like Iowa, where it's kind of like the Electoral College and the popular vote, you have to show strength throughout the state. You can't just run up the score in college towns or cities. You have to be able to do well in rural areas, and you have to do well in all kinds of smaller towns. So will he ultimately be able to say he got the most votes? That may be true when we get a final number, if ever. But that also makes it more confusing for voters, right?
Here's a question that I've gotten a lot, Amy, from national reporters over the last couple of days. How much will Iowa's troubles bring New Hampshire down? After Iowa's fiasco, people here in New Hampshire were feeling pretty smug, and we talked to the chair of the DNC here, and he said, well, we've got a real primary, kind of what you said, you know, real primary, real ballots, real counting machines, no pizza boxes. Mm-hmm. But some people are saying, look, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire have been joined at the hip for a long time,
right,
and we've defended each other. So, and I asked the DNC chair, or the state party chair, this, you know, is it time to break up with Iowa so that we don't go down the drain with them? Does Iowa's trouble bring New Hampshire down?
I mean, I think there were already challenges before this. So I do think, as I said, there is certainly more momentum now than I've ever seen to upend this process. While we were going around the state interviewing today, we asked that same question to a couple folks, also from the state Democratic Party, about, well, why not do something like where, well, let me back up. When you ask, ask folks here in New Hampshire about, you know, do you really need to be first? Like, what's the big deal? Well, we're so good at this in 100 years, and we kick the tires, we do it really well. you're not so diverse. I know, but you know what? Right after us, you do New Hampshire. I mean, you do Nevada and South Carolina. And you put us all together, right? Like, put us in a blender. That looks like America, right? You take us individually, not so much. Put us all together. And I said, well, why not just do all four of you on the same day? That's America, right? You get Nevada, South Carolina, Iowa, New Hampshire, and you can argue that's a pretty good, again, in a blender, representation of the electorate. And the answer was something like, but we want to be first, you know? So I get it. Nobody wants to willingly give up their spot, right? Well, I give it up, and without a fight, it has been their place for a very long time. So it is going to need to happen, really, with a Democratic. If Democrats win the White House, that's the only person who could really make those changes. Even then, do they want to spend their political capital on that, right? You're a brand new president. You got a lot of work to do. You want to keep your party unified behind you. Is that high on your list of, like, you know what? Before we do healthcare, one thing I need to do, get rid of the caucuses and New Hampshire primary.
Well, and after the New Hampshire primary and Nevada and South Carolina, we'll be moving on to Super Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And it's just worth reminding ourselves, Amy, what that is and how it came to be, because it's a relatively new invention. I mean, it's been around for a while, yeah. But just remind us what Super Tuesday is and what that's all about.
Okay, so I am older than some, look, but I don't remember there ever not being a Super Tuesday. I'll just say that. So, you know what? It has been one of these opportunities for states that aren't the first four to get some influence, right? So let's sort of band together. In some years, it's Midwestern states that were the Super Tuesday states. So it was a way to bring presidential candidates to your state to give some prominence to Illinois or Ohio. This year, it's pretty diversified. The two biggest states are in here, California and Texas, both of whom feel overlooked all the time in Democratic politics, right? Especially California. You come, you want our money, but you never spend any time here because we're so blue that you don't need to woo us. Now, if we move up the calendar, you're going to have to spend more time and money here. But there are also a lot of southern states in the mix, Alabama, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Virginia. So it's a mix. It really is a very diverse day in terms of the electorate.
So it's changed, sounds
yeah.
like.
Yeah. I mean, the states that end up in Super Tuesday, it's really, you know, there are rules about when you can, as a state, go in the calendar. And so whatever the rules are, and they change every 4 years, but if you go after a certain date, you get bonus delegates. If you wait, in other words, to try to spread out, or if they want to encourage maybe a front-loaded process because they want to get this over quickly, you'll get a bonus for going earlier. If you recall, in the 2008 election, Florida and Michigan were disqualified because they went outside of the window, and so they did not have delegates. They ultimately, of course, had delegates at the convention, but their delegates were not part of the process in picking the nominee. So that is usually how that works. States really picking to move up to a time like this to really show some influence. And it's paying off, literally. At TV stations in those Super Tuesday states, thanks to a guy named Mike Bloomberg, who is spending, I don't know, it's probably more than $300 million right now just in advertising. And if you turn on your television in any of those places, you will see not just one or two, you will see a lot of those ads. And look, this has been the posture of places like Iowa and New Hampshire for years, which is, see, look, this is why small states matter, because you can't go do retail campaigning in California and Texas. And the only way to play there is to have billions of dollars and go up on TV. And so the billionaires win, right? Is that what we want? Okay. Fair question. But what good, you know, but you still need to show beyond TV ads, right, that you are a candidate that can build a coalition that can last you throughout. So what's fascinating to me is, as I look to Super Tuesday, again, traditionally, Iowa and New Hampshire have helped to winnow the field. In modern times, at least since I've been covering campaigns, no Democrat has won the nomination without winning Iowa or New Hampshire or both. So we could be looking at the first time where we're going to have a not only different winners, that's not new, but that maybe those two winners of those states don't go on to be the nominee. We could have different winners in the first four primary states. That would be something kind of new. And going into then Super Tuesday with a really kind of muddled mess. Again, you all are supposed to help narrow it down to get to two candidates, maybe three, and then the other two early primary states finish the winnowing, and you get to Super Tuesday, and it's X versus Y, and then we figure out, okay, who's the most likely to be the nominee? Because by the time we get through this year with Super Tuesday, about 40% of all delegates will have been allocated. So by the end of March, it's, I think, 60%.
Wow.
So
that's coming up
very soon. That's coming up soon. And the more muddled this looks, the more the discussion turns to, will we finally get something that political reporters are dying and political scientists have been dying to cover, which is an actual contested convention, a convention where we don't know who the nominee is before we show up.
So fun for political reporters, but
not
probably pretty terrible for the party.
Yeah. Correct. Correct.
I have a couple more questions. Okay. In fact, I have a bunch more questions, but I want to also open it up to the audience. So just a few more. And Amy, I'm so struck by you telling us that Super Tuesday includes this time Texas and California. So this kind of relates to what you just said. But so we could know very soon because Texas and California are enormous.
They're enormous. But here's the thing about the Democratic primary. And this is different from the Republican primary. Every primary state or caucus state allocates its delegates proportionally. Right. So you can win a state, but you don't win all of its delegates if some other candidate got at least 15%. So, and it's not just the statewide vote, it's also by congressional district. So think how many congressional districts California has. You can win a couple delegates out of certain types of congressional districts, right? Like maybe you do really well in and around the cities of Los Angeles or San Francisco, or you have strength in the more rural parts of the state, in the Central Valley, something like that. So it doesn't get you a ton of delegates, but what it means is that it is unlike the Republican primary, where if you win, you get all the delegates.
Winner take all.
Winner take all. It is hard to build a really big lead, especially if there are multiple candidates splitting up those delegates. And
what's
it's hard to catch
behind
up.
Behind that?
I think the philosophy behind that was to ensure that someone didn't run away with this. I mean, this is part of the problem with the winner take all, right? If someone's winning those delegates and it's not someone who the party wants, well, there's no way to stop them, right? You can run up the score. Here, you really do have to be, and you have to show strength across different types of regions and, you know, caucuses versus primaries and things like that. You know, what happened in 2016 to Republicans in some ways was what a proportional system would have prevented, prevent, which is a candidate from the outside that is not part of the party establishment, Donald Trump, who was going to be able to win states without, you know, there was no, like, break within the system there. There are no superdelegates. There are no, and there is not proportional voting. So the breaks within the Democratic Party make that harder to do.
Even though it's more convoluted and more confusing, the Democrats at least feel like it's more fair.
Theoretically, but let's say, okay, it has worked so far. See, this is the thing about it. Every system, it works until it doesn't. And most people don't pay attention to this, to delegates, because it is, it's super detail heavy and it's exhausting to cover and to understand. So there aren't many people who follow it and do the are very good at understanding how to do this. But the people who are very sought after. That said, the possibility of someone getting through this entire process, it's June and nobody has a majority of delegates, well, where does that leave the party? Now, on the one hand, this is why you had superdelegates, right? That was the theory, was, okay, the superdelegates, the people whose job as the establishment, as the leaders of the party, these are members of Congress, these are chairs and vice chairs of the Democratic National Committee, governors, things like that, they're invested in the party, and as such, they should have a voice in who the party picks as the nominee. Of course, a lot of people think, well, that's not fair. It is, they have a bigger footprint and a bigger voice than the people who actually showed up and cast their ballots. That doesn't seem right. So this year, the Democratic Party said, okay, we still have superdelegates, but they only come into play if on the first ballot, okay, so you go and vote. Remember, if you've seen on TV at the conventions, right? The great state of New Hampshire, home of the granite rock, you know, blah, 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 whatever. New Hampshire loves to brag about itself, right? Casts its blah, blah, many delegates for, right? Okay. And it's just a, in every convention in this era, it's been just a perfunctory process. But now what it would mean is each state casts their votes. And then let's say there's still nobody gets 50%. Then the superdelegates can come to play on the second ballot. Which would be the great irony, right? That part of the reason that folks wanted the superdelegates gone was they thought, well, we shouldn't let party insiders decide who our nominee is, when at the end of the day, the party insiders could help decide who the nominee it really is in this process. So that reality is out there of, well, what happens in June? We get through this. There are still three or four candidates who have delegates. Nobody got to 50%. But what if somebody's at 46%? Should that person just get it? Because they're close?
Especially if the superdelegates say, no, they want somebody else. Correct. Then the supporters of that person who gets 46
correct
are pretty upset.
Correct. Or if two of those other candidates say, hey, I got an idea. Look, you and me, ours together, we're 50. And this person's 46. Let's tell our delegates to vote for you, okay? I'll give my delegates to you.
And you can be my vice president.
And right. And that way we'll have 50%. You think those 46% people are going to be happy about that? Oh, my God. So this is like a whole new territory. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but we are, when we set up for, when you see that the, how our assumptions about this, and will change as we get through. We are only through one voting process. Like, we got a long way to go.
And not even really quite through that one yet.
I just ended my column today by saying, like, we just have to accept that we don't know what's going to happen and be okay with that. And to accept that we live in a time now where we should expect the unexpected and stop trying to shove things into boxes. I love doing this too. I love thinking, like, well, this kind of reminds me of the 2012 election, or is this 1984 and Gary Hart. Is this the, right? But there are parallels, but we're also in a very different moment. And you combine that with Bloomberg, who it may turn out to be nothing, but somebody who is worth, what is it, 60-something billion dollars cannot be completely ignored in this process, and who is moving up in national and in state polls.